Thank you, BC. I think we can shut the air conditioning off.
Yeah.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in the state of Texas versus Willie LeVan Jr., or the Attorney General of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles G. Childress will present argument for petitioner. Mr. Childress has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Petitioner is here seeking to reverse a summary judgment of non-paternity in favor of respondent granted by the trial court and affirmed by the Third Court of Appeals. Proper statutory construction, due respect to judicial precedent, and public policy all mandate that the question of paternity of Damon Eugene Fleming be resolved by trial on the merits after scientific paternity testing. The relevant facts are in fact undisputed. Crystal Fleming was married to one Willie Fleming in August of 1980. The marriage was formally dissolved by a decree of divorce entered in October of 86. That decree provided for one child of the marriage, a girl, but failed to mention in any way Damon Eugene Fleming, a child born to Crystal Fleming on September 13, 1985. In March of 88, the Child Support Division of the Texas Attorney General filed a suit seeking to establish that the father of Damon Fleming was Willie Latham. Latham defended on the grounds the child had a presumed father, Willie Fleming, who, although not adjudicated to be the father, was married to the mother at the time of the child's conception and birth. This is not a new defense. It was urged by Mr. Blackshear in the 1978 Waco Court of Appeals case cited in my brief at page 21. But this may be the first time that it's been successful on summary judgment when raised by the alleged father. Fleming was added as a party by the state for the sole purpose of seeking paternity testing, but such testing was never ordered by the trial court. The problem that the Court of Appeals had, of course, was with language in section 13.01 of the Family Code. However, I think that in order to understand that language, we must start with the presumptions themselves. The presumptions under section 1202 of the Texas Family Code is a presumption that the man is the biological father of a child. To hold, as the trial court and the Court of Appeals have in this case, that this presumption of paternity due to marital status of the mother precludes evidence which could prove or disprove the biological connection, stands the entire statutory scheme on its head. There are at least 8 possible ways to show a presumption under 1202 of the Family Code. Section 1206, which is mentioned in the Court of Appeals opinion, and is entitled denial of paternity, only applies to one situation, and that is a husband or wife. Thus, on a literal reading of the Court of Appeals opinion and the statute, all of the other presumptions would be irrebuttable. This clearly cannot be the intent, and there is an alternative explanation. Section 1206 provides any suit affecting parent-child relationship other than a suit under Chapter 13 of this code. A husband or wife is entitled to deny the husband's paternity. It goes on to say that if this happens, there must be paternity testing conducted in accordance with Chapter 13. There must be a pretrial conference as provided in Chapter 13. The result of a successful denial of paternity in a suit between the husband and wife, to which no other alleged father is joined, would be to leave the child with no father at all, until another possible father is identified and established. Considering this impact on the child, the requirement for paternity testing is very appropriate. The Court of Appeals indicated that a, quote, stipulation of issuable fact would be a sufficient substitute for paternity testing, but the statute on its face does not permit such a stipulation, and the danger of permitting a stipulation of non-paternity is well illustrated by the situation in Attorney General of Texas OBO Ridge and Garcia versus Ridge. In that case, the husband claimed to have had a vasectomy. The wife had, in fact, had an affair with another man during the course of the marriage. During the divorce action, the parties agreed to an order excluding Mr. Ridge as father of the child. Subsequently, in a paternity action against the apparent or assumed father, he was excluded. Subsequently, also, Mr. Ridge had 2 children by another woman. Now, A stipulation as to an issuable fact is not sufficient, and the statute so provides. So paternity testing is mandatory. When there is a suit affecting the parent-child relationship, its denial is pursuant to Section 1206. But how can this work in a situation where a husband is dead or cannot be located? In that case, there may be no need for a suit affecting the parent-child relationship at all between the husband and wife, but there may very well be an urgent need to establish a relationship with the actual father for the benefit of the child. If the suit in which the presumption is to be rebutted is not other than a suit under Chapter 13, i.e., it is a suit under Chapter 13, then the child need not be bastardized by an order rebutting the presumption, since the same order can identify and establish a father for the child, unless, of course, both fathers are excluded. If the husband is dead or disappeared, paternity tests on the alleged father and testimony of non-access may be more than sufficient to rebut the presumption without paternity testing on the presumed father. This construction is consistent with prior case law, notably DWL versus NJBC, which is cited at page 21 of my brief. In that 1980 writ refused NRE case out of Houston, the mother was permitted to testify to non-access, which was a ground at that time, by the legitimate father as a part of the paternity case which established the biological father of the child. Common sense construction of the statutory scheme would not only allow, but would require that a paternity suit be permitted to proceed together with the suit to rebut one or more of the Chapter 12 presumptions. This court, Justice Mosley writing, recently affirmed the substantial constitutional rights of illegitimate children in Dixon versus Simpson. A presumed father may, in many instances, be no father at all. The right to establish true paternity should no more be conditioned on the voluntary actions of a presumed father than on the voluntary actions of an alleged biological father.
Well, while that argument may be compelling, what are we to do with the language of the statute, which says that the action can be brought between regarding a child who has no presumed father? What is the answer to the Court of Appeals' position that your argument just reads that phrase out of the statute?
I can't defend the draftsmanship, Your Honor, which inserted who has no presumed father in that section of the Family Code, but I have in my brief attempted to show how the language got there, and that it was not intended to reverse 16 years of progress.
But
clearly we're not...
Even that aside,
yes,
is there any way to construe this statute in your favor, in the way you're asking us to construe it, except just to ignore that phrase, those words, who has no presumed father?
Yes, sir. You can say simply that before you get a final order in such a case, the presumptions must be, of course, rebutted. We are not, like Louisiana case, a state in which you may have two or more fathers obligated to support an individual, a particular child. It does not necessarily mean that the filing itself is not permissible. Yes, sir.
The statute didn't read that way at the time this suit was brought, though, did it?
No, sir, it did
not. At the time this suit was brought, didn't the statute say a child who is not the legitimate child of a man?
Yes, Your Honor, at the time, frankly, we have proceeded with this case as far as we have, because the statute now reads that way, and it's important to the state to go ahead and resolve this issue. At the time that the case was brought,
in your brief, you say there's no difference.
Yes, sir. At the time the suit was filed, the statute spoke of a legitimate child of a man in Section 1202, but it also said you could bring a suit.
It said that in 1301A, didn't it?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And in 1202A, it created a rebuttable presumption
that the child was the legitimate child of a man. So the language was changed.
You don't believe that was a substantive revision?
No, sir.
Because instead of saying, presumed, it says not legitimate child of a man.
Well,
it created no presumption in 1301A at the time you brought the suit.
At the time we brought the suit, 1301A mirrored 1202A in virtually the same way it mirrors it now. At that time, 1202 provided that a child born during the marriage was legitimate child of that marriage. That same language
created a rebuttable presumption.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Created a rebuttable presumption.
But the language of 1301A is now much stronger.
It is. It is much stronger because of the change that was made.
But that was not the language under which the suit was filed.
No, sir. It's not.
It's the old language.
Although there was an amended petition to establish filed after September 1st of 89, which is the effective date of the statute.
Directing your attention in a little different way, are you familiar with the very recent Beaumont Court of Appeals in Gibson against in the interest of JWT?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Does that opinion have implications for our decision in this case, as you are in the direction you're urging it, or will our opinion in this case have implications for Gibson?
Well, of course, Gibson is based upon due process of law with regard to the rights of a presumed father. If Gibson is followed, then obviously this must be written out of the statute with regard to the constitutional rights of the presumed father. I would simply say that the rights of the child are much more deserving of protecting and much less, the child's due process, I think, is also involved. And yes, I think if Gibson is correct, then this makes our case much stronger for setting aside that particular language.
But so I'll be clear, you are only arguing and only asking us to decide this case based upon the language of Section 1301 as it now exists.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the Court of Appeals made a fundamental error in its approach to the case. What it did was characterize this action as a filiation proceeding, which is defined as a special statutory proceeding criminal in form for the purpose of establishing parentage and the putative father's rights, duty to support his illegitimate child. It's consistent with that view to take a narrow reading of the statute if you consider it essentially a criminal statute. That's not the direction this court has been going for 16 years. 16 years ago, you said that rules that exclude evidence bearing directly on the truth to be determined it ought not to survive without very good cause, in Davis versus Davis, in which you struck down Lord Mansfield's rule. 3 years ago, you reminded the Court of Appeals, the Courts of Appeals, in this state, that the objective of this exercise is to establish the paternity of the child. And in the interest of SCB, you said that it was appropriate for the trial court to admit both evidence to rebut the presumed father and evidence to establish the biological father in the same proceeding. Now, as I said, the language has changed. But as I show in my brief, it has not been changed with intent to change the substance, and it is not, I think, appropriate to impose an additional burden on a child in a situation such as this, based upon that language change. The process for rebutting presumptions and the process for establishing paternity is much simpler and much less expensive than it was 20 years ago. As this court observed in Murdoch versus Murdoch this summer, paternity test results, if there is a presumed father that's available, are conclusive as to non-paternity. We're not asking the court to do something that's very complicated. We're not putting either of alleged fathers at great risk of spending a great deal of time and money fighting the case. I think Gibson certainly supports this court's opinions in Dixon versus Simpson a few years ago in Garza versus Maverick, and recognizing the rights of the child in due process rights of the child to establish the true father. The Court of Appeals, in the case below, said, if the presumed father wishes to disestablish the parent-child relationship resulting from the presumption and the attendant system of legal rights and obligations, he must do so in another proceeding affecting the parent-child relationship, in which proceeding he defeats the presumption by showing and establishing that he is not, in fact, the child's biological father. The best that can be said for this proposition is that it requires two legal actions for one would do. Besides the obvious waste of judicial resources, there are other problems with the view. First, it places the child's rights to establish the actual father at the mercy of the voluntary actions of the presumed father, who may have no incentive or ability to file such a suit. Legal rights and obligations do not exist in a vacuum. They are not self-effectuating, yet the Family Code makes no provision for independent suit to rebut the presumption, unless you take my view of the statute. It is unclear what kind of legal action might be filed by the state or the mother to resolve this issue. Can the mother of the state file a suit to deny paternity against the presumed father? Or must we file a suit for support against a man known or believed not to be the father in order to compel a denial by him? And what happens if such a man defaults? If somehow the state could file a suit seeking on behalf of the wife to rebut the presumed paternity of her husband, failure of the man to answer would certainly result, or presumably result, in a default judgment of non-paternity. What if the state and the mother are mistaken, as the mother was in Ridge?
Any questions?
Well, I have one question before you sit down. Is there any evidence that Mr. Levin has acknowledged paternity on several occasions?
No, Your Honor. The evidence presented at summary judgment was that Mrs. Fleming had a relationship with him for several years before and during the period when the child was conceived, and the evidence of non-access as to the Mr. Fleming. There was not discovery done which would give us evidence of acknowledgement. No, sir.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from appellee. Respondent, excuse me, I'm getting my time.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark M. Humble will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, this action was initiated by the Attorney General's office as a direct Chapter 13 action, naming only Louie Levin initially as the alleged biological father of the child. It's an interesting allegation because as it develops during the course of discovery of the case, discovery by Mr. Levin, there was in fact a presumed father in existence. The presumed father, of course, was Mr. Flemings, the man to whom Mrs. Flemings was married both at the time of conception and birth of the child. The pleadings of the Attorney General's office consistently from beginning until the time of the summary judgment motion read as follows. The presumptive legal father of the child, because he was married to the mother of the child at the time the child was conceived and or born, is Willie E. Flemings. Therefore, there is a presumption, of course, that Flemings is in fact the father of the child, there never having been a rebuttal of that presumption under Chapter 1206 of the Family Code. Section 1206, of course, is the vehicle by which husbands and wives, because it defines the parties who would engage in a 1206 action as husbands and wives, are able to deny paternity of a child. The language of that code section is not precatory, it's mandatory, and provides that person desiring to contest paternity shall file an express statement denying paternity, and then it proceeds to direct the trial judge or trial court as to how it is to order certain testing be done. That also is not precatory, but is instead mandatory. That, of course, was not done here.
Why?
Judge, I frankly don't know. It seems to me that the proper recourse for the Attorney General's office in retrospect would have been to have non-suited this Chapter 13 action filed when they discovered that there was in fact a presumptive father, or to have filed a plea of abatement.
There was never any request that the trial court order the alleged father, the alleged biological father, and the presumed father, and the mother and the child to have blood tests?
Interestingly, there may have been at one stage a request concerning Mr. Levin, but I believe the Attorney General's office actually assisted the presumed father in the filing of a waiver of interest in the child. But the point, from my perspective, is that to satisfy the hurdle that Chapter 13 poses in its opening phraseology, it would have been a relatively simple matter, I believe, to have filed a plea and abatement to initiate another action to rebut the presumption elsewhere, or to have non-suited either one, neither which was done.
Why is the state not right that you can rebut the presumption in the action?
The basic problem, I think, with that, Your Honor, is that that does violence to the language of Chapter 13. Chapter 13, it appears to me, is designed to protect a family relationship where there is a presumption of legitimacy or a presumption of paternity. It seems designed to protect those situations where there is a husband and wife and a marriage of some sort. It seems to me, and the case that comes out of Beaumont is a good example of this, it seems that the legislature would not have wanted the marital relationship to be invaded pursuant to a Chapter 13 action without there first having been a rebuttal of the presumption under Chapter 12.
Certainly they didn't contemplate that a child would not be provided for in the divorce decree and would be left without a legal parent, legal father.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Your Honor, because it would...
I guess that's a question.
Yes, sir. It would appear, frankly, to me as though Mr. Flemings may, as a matter of law, be the father of the child for not having alleged and pled, in accordance with Chapter 1206, that he was not the father of the child at the time the divorce proceeding occurred. He may, in fact, be stopped now from denying that he
was the
father.
Was there a pleading that he was? That there was, I was under the impression there was a pleading that there was a single child of that marriage, and that divorce decree granted support based upon that single child. And this child was just omitted completely. Is that correct or incorrect?
It's correct, Your Honor. This child was omitted completely. It would seem, however, because of the code provision that one lists all of the children born during the course of the marriage, that he may, in fact, be estopped now to deny that that child is, in fact, the child of that marriage.
Section 1301 says suit may be brought, or suit between a child who is not the presumed to be the child, legitimate child, and the child's biological father. Yet you don't know whether the alleged father, the alleged biological father, is actually the biological father until the cause of action is over with. Why isn't that true with the presumption also?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
You say that whether the child is presumed to be legitimate is a condition to the bringing of the suit under 1301.
Yes, sir.
The suit also, the section also allows only an action against the child's biological father. Yet you don't know that the defendant in the case is the biological father until the case is over with. Why, if you have to prove biological fatherhood, don't you also get a chance to disprove presumed fatherhood?
I believe the code is designed so that Chapter 13 is a catchment. It's designed to catch all of those children who aren't otherwise caught. The term, who has no presumed father, I think is a pretty explicit term. Chapter 12 talks about all of those who have a presumed father.
Well, but so is biological father. But the mere fact that the state sues someone does not make them the biological father of the child.
Well, that's correct, but the state and the biological father and state agencies and other parties are not allowed to initiate an action under 1301 in the marriage context without first having been invited in the marriage context pursuant to 1206.
But they're saying outside, even outside the marriage context, under Chapter 13, the state still has to prove that the defendant is the biological father.
That would be correct, yes, sir.
Why doesn't the state get to disprove that there is a presumed father?
I missed that.
Why doesn't the state get to disprove that there is a presumed father?
Well, that was the point of filing in the trial court, is the state should have proven that there was no presumed father. And in fact, the state in its pleadings and in the summary judgment evidence stipulated that there was a presumed father and continued its march forward under Chapter 13 when Chapter 13 in its...
Well, if they prove that the child is biologically the child of another person, don't they rebut the presumption that this other person is the father?
I don't believe Chapter 13 anticipates that where a child is born to a husband and wife or conceived to a husband and wife, because Section 1206 is the means by which either a husband and wife, insofar as a child conceived or born during marriage, is entitled to deny the paternity. If that has happened in the marriage relationship, then one is entitled to turn to Chapter 13.
But Section 11, 1.01, defines illegitimate child as a child who is the biological child of a man whose paternity has not been adjudicated by a court of competent jurisdiction. Why isn't that what's going on in the 1301 action?
Well, again, I think 1301 is designed as a catchment, solely to catch those children who have no presumed fathers. You either fall into one category or you fall into the other by definition. And until you've exhausted the presumed fathers, you're not even entitled to file the 1301. If that were not the case, it would seem to me, logically speaking, that we could have some state agency that has been paying Medicaid payments and decides, for example, that even though these husband and wife are happy as a bug with the child, and neither of which neither of whom decides to challenge the paternity of the child, that it has a better opportunity of getting reimbursement of its monies paid, that it should then initiate an action under 1301 into the marriage relationship, even though neither of the parties under Section 1206 chose to deny paternity, but were very happy with the circumstances as they were. Frankly, that was the Beaumont situation, at least in part, where I believe an alleged biological father attempted to come in to the marriage relationship where neither the husband nor wife intended that he come in. And I think Section 1301 is designed specifically to prohibit that, to protect the family unit as it were.
What about cases, though, as the state argues, where they're not happy as a bug, they just, no one else has any incentive to bring the action? The state is the only one with any incentive.
I believe that probably there could be an action initiated on behalf of the child under Section 1206, at least potentially on behalf of the child, who would perhaps not be bound by the restrictions of Section 1206. Frankly, that may have been the correct recourse here. Back in the trial court, there's an action brought by the next friend on behalf of the child. But again, it does, I think, serious violence to the terms, the opening statement in 1301 to, in effect, read it out. And if you read that out, it's pretty plain that a number of people, including the alleged biological father, suddenly are able to come into the marriage envelope. Whereas in the past, it's pretty plain, I think the legislature did not intend that.
So you're saying this child would not necessarily be bound by the presumption that his father, who was divorced from his mother, was presumably his father, and this adjudication would not be bound by either one of them. It could still establish by way of a guardian ad litem appointed by the court to protect its interests that who in fact is the biological father.
Potentially, yes, sir. If I were in the position of representing the child, however, in that action, presumably in Travis County to reform the decree, I think I would take the position that both husband and wife are stopped to deny the paternity of the child. And the child is, in fact, the child of that marriage because it would achieve the support that the child would want from a known father. It would also make the child legitimate, which I think the legislature prefers under Chapter 12.
There is a pretty clear legislatively articulated public policy in favor of the child not falling through the cracks. Would you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
It's your view that the child won't fall through the cracks despite the state's argument.
Yes,
there is another procedure that can accomplish what the state's trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. In fact, it is my belief that probably both husband and wife are in fact stopped to deny that the child is a child of marriage, and I think the child is probably through an attorney ad litem or an next friend able to establish that, or should be.
Or the child could prove that the biological father, if it was not the father of the marriage, it would not be a stop to prove that either, would it? Or would it?
Possibly. In fact, my understanding is there is some thinking to the effect that the child is probably not bound by the dictates of some of these statutory guidelines, but most of that is speculation, I think.
I'm trying to understand what you're saying here. You're saying that this summary judgment determination on the contesting the Mr. Laban's paternity is not raised judicata against the child. The child can come back in and establish Mr. Laban's paternity.
I think as to Mr. Levan in the Milam County proceeding, it may well be raised judicata as to all parties. Frankly, I have not gone that one step further to ask myself whether or not the child himself is somehow bound by that process.
That's the bottom line. My question, you know, we have an awkwardly phrased statute that was amended during the process of these proceedings in the trial court. Some questionable pleadings, some faulty action perhaps on the part of counsel. Does this leave the child twisting in the legal winds?
No, sir, I don't think so. I think basically what happened here again was an effort of putting a square peg in a round hole, and rather than abating or dismissing the Attorney General for whatever reason, has sought to try to force this court to change the language that's written in Section 1301. Now, I guess one may say, well, what about this single child? And I guess what I would say is, what about all of the families who become subjected to attacks?
But we have the case of this single child before us, and the question is, Where is the child protected in this process, constitutionally or otherwise, constitutionally, statutorily, or equitably? Where is the child protected in this process to have established, or at least where is the child protected in its effort, or someone in its behalf, to establish the paternity of its true father?
It would seem to me, Your Honor, that the child actually is entitled to claim the protection of the marriage relationship.
I'm talking about establishing the paternity of its true biological father, whoever it may be.
Assuming that the husband was not the child's father.
Assuming the husband was not. The mother has disavowed the father, the husband's paternity. The husband has disavowed paternity. Mr. Levon apparently at some point has exercised what you would consider paternal obligations towards the child.
Your Honor, it seems to me that if the guide here is the best interest of the child, which I think is all of, conditions all of these kinds of statements, if the issue actually is the best interest of the child, it seemed to me from the perspective of the child that his best interest is served by legitimating that child, by making him a child of a marriage.
Well, I think the disabilities, other than perhaps social stigma, but the disabilities of illegitimacy aren't what they used to be, and that strong presumption in favor of legitimacy may not be what it used to be as a result.
I suppose it depends on what part of the state one's from. I consider it still to be a pretty strong public policy where I'm from, and a significant stigma for any child who has the misfortune of being rendered illegitimate.
There was a strong, historically, presumption of legitimacy because of the legal disabilities that were imposed upon a child if they were found to be illegitimate. Those disabilities have been neutralized, diluted, and in most cases no longer exist. There's some of them still do exist.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, with all due respect, that Chapter 1206 is actually designed to, again, permit the child the use of that marital envelope unless one of the two parents...
Chapter 1206, as you pointed out, was not pled. It was not pleaded.
Right.
They brought it under, what, 1113 and 15, or 1113 and 14, and left 12 out.
Well, it was essentially brought, Your Honor, under Chapter 13. As
right.
My client. But I think the policy underlying Section 1206 is to prevent even parents from finagling with the court that they are not the parents of the child. It requires instead that scientific testing be done to satisfy the court that in fact they are not the parents.
I'm still concerned about, and I'm not sure I understood your response while I go to Justice Heck's question regarding, even though this was brought under 13, as a part of the 13th proceeding, couldn't they comply with the 12 requirements of rebutting the presumption of paternity of the mother's husband and proceed with their efforts to establish paternity under Section 13?
Well, that's interesting because I think the Attorney General finally figured that out, but I think it's fair to say at the rehearing stage before the Court of Appeals, in which they complained, I believe, for the first time, that the action should have been abated until such time as they had been allowed to go forward with the Section 1206 proof. And frankly, that would have been a proper thing, I think, to have done at the trial level, either to have non-suited, since there's no limitations problem for the child, or to have sought an abatement, neither of which was sought.
Well, an abatement or a dismissal would have been appropriate to avoid a summary judgment so that you don't have a situation we talked about before, and that is a res judicata judgment against the child.
Yes, sir.
And the trial court presumably could have done that without a motion, but wasn't coming upon.
Well, I believe actually it's required to have been pled or requested because there's been complained about that in the field.
I'm not sure when you've got the interest of the child in.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Is there any rebuttal? How much rebuttal time is remaining?
5 minutes.
Respond, please, counsel, to the first argument that if you take out the presumed father phrase in the statute, you empower the Attorney General as a kind of a roving paladin, getting more lucrative fathers for children.
I don't quite know how to respond to that, Your Honor. There has to be some evidence upon which the state can act. It's difficult to see what suit exactly that appellee has in mind. If the state filed suit for support, knowing that the presumed father could not possibly be the biological father, as for example in Young versus Young Man's in prison, in Blackshear, Sergeant Dugan was stationed in Germany, then would not such a suit be frivolous? Wouldn't the state be subject to claim for filing a frivolous action? If such a man defaults and you wind up with a support order, what about the enforcement problems? There's a case out of Houston which I believe is coming before this court, Dreyer versus Green, which involves just that situation. You have a man who thinks he's not the biological father, who is the judicially, in fact, in that case, adjudicated biological father, and it's not easy to collect support from him. There's a case out of El Paso, Linder, in which such a man attempted to terminate his own parental rights because he was not the biological father. You're asking for a lot of future problems.
If the mother does not complain, and if the presumed father does not complain, why should the state get to bring another cause of action?
There's absolutely no reason, and I think such an action would be frivolous. Where would the evidence come from?
I'm saying to
initiate the action.
If the presumed father does not disavow the child,
right.
Then you should not get to bring a cause of action yourself.
I guess the problem I'm having with that is I can't imagine where you would get the background evidence to do such a thing unless one of the other parties brings that up to the agency. The Court of Appeals opinion does not stand on its own terms. Counsel for Appellee has correctly pointed out that the only real way to support a summary judgment is to say that a man in the position of Mr. Fleming's has blown his opportunity to deny paternity and is thereafter forever to be the father of the child. The Court of Appeals didn't go that far. Willie Fleming's most likely still has a cause of action to deny paternity and will succeed if there was no access. The child would, since he's not been made a party to this action, have a theoretical remedy in another paternity suit against Boy Layton. But that suit would be complicated by the history of this case, and the state would no doubt be barred from bringing it. By what mechanism then would Damon Eugene Fleming's assert his theoretical right to legitimation?
Counsel, you did not request a blood test from anybody?
Your Honor, our amended petition, yes, did request blood testing of all parties, of the alleged father, the presumed father, and the mother.
The trial court denied?
Well, the trial court did not consider that. Well, it's essentially denied it because of entering the summary judgment and not returning.
Well, you did not urge your motion.
We did urge it. I don't think there's a separate order overruling the blood test, Your Honor.
Well, in your response to the summary judgment, did you even mention or remind the court that you had requested the blood test?
I'm afraid you've hit one part of the record I can't honestly. I think we did, but I couldn't swear to it. The response, though, does urge our pleadings, and our pleadings do ask for paternity testing. I believe that's in our response.
Any other questions? Have you concluded, counsel? Thank you. That concludes the argument and the second calls. The foregoing calls are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Marshall will now please adjourn the court for the day.
The audience will please rise.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned. Subject to call.